It's not about us.
Okay, good morning. It is Thursday, March 24th, 2011, 10 a.m. in the North Dakota Public Service Commission hearing room.
It is not 10 a.m.
Or it's 10:30, you're right. We were scheduled to start at 10 a.m. It is about 10:35 or 10:40 here at the North Dakota Public Service Commission hearing room. Thank you for your indulgence in delaying the start of this. I was testifying on behalf of the commission on House Bill 1406, which is in front of the Senate Transportation Committee, and they were running just a hair behind schedule.
And they didn't accurate. We asked to your demands that they not. Accommodate your.
Yeah. Oh well.
So unlike them.
Welcome everyone this morning. Are there any welcoming comments from my fellow commissioners?
No, we talked about you while you were gone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, with that, we have items on the consent agenda.
I move passage of the items in the consent agenda.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. I have one item in my portfolio. Let's see. We have two items. TC1, I move the commission file the report and recommendation of trustee with district court recommending that the trust fund proceeds in this case be distributed to the claimant based upon his valid cash sale claim, that proceeds from the credit sale contract indemnity be distributed among the claimants based on their valid credit sale contract claims, and that the commission's expenses be provided by state law. I further move that once court approval is obtained, claimants be paid as soon as possible in Organic Grain and Milling, Inc., Grain Warehouse Insolvency, case number GE10-327.
Second.
Okay, in this case, there were six claims that were filed totaling just over $220,000. The valid cash claim amount that's recommended for payment by the commission totals $17,276.88, as shown below, and that's to Mr. Hapka, and which is a percentage of the claim that was filed. The commission further recommends that credit sale contracts be paid at 80% of valid claims as provided by law. There were a number of those as well, and four credit sale contracts were accepted as valid claims, and at the 80% threshold that's defined in law, that will total just over $150,000 from the credit sale indemnity fund. In addition, the commission is recommending that one claim in the amount of $8,200, roughly, for repair work at the grain warehouse in Clyde and not from a grain purchase be denied, as shown below. And that's because it's not valid as a claim under state law.
All in favor?
Aye.
This will now go to district court for approval, rejection, or modification, and petitioners would have the ability to bring claims in front of the court. TC2, I move the commission issue a notice of filing and notice of hearing in the application of Minn Kota Power Co-op, Inc. for a certificate of corridor compatibility for its proposed 345 kV electric transmission line from Center to Grand Forks, North Dakota, case number PU09670.
Second.
This sets public hearings for a number of locations. This is a significant transmission line, both in terms of its length as well as in terms of its size. A 345 is a substantial electric transmission line. Because of the nature of the line running all the way from center in the central part of North Dakota all the way to the northeastern part of the state in Grand Forks, we're actually proposing doing three separate hearings. This is more than is required by law, but we want to give people an opportunity along the length of the line to testify if they have any questions or concerns. The three hearings will be on May 3rd at 9 a.m. at the Grand Forks City Commission Room, and that's at 151 South 4th Street. The second hearing is May 4th, 2011, 9 a.m. at the Chieftain Conference Center in Carrington, and the third one is May 13th, 2011, 9 a.m. at Memorial Hall in Washburn. One of the things that I would note in this is the way that Minn Kota has filed it is actually the manner in which the law contemplates, which is not traditional practice, actually, in the state. You may recall that with most of the transmission lines that the commission has cited, we combine the corridor and route permit. The corridor is the larger geographic area in which a line may go, and then the route is the actual physical location of the line within that corridor. State law contemplates two separate proceedings in which first a corridor is narrowed down and cited, and then a line is cited. In most cases, the utility recommends or petitions to have those consolidated, and in most cases, the commission agrees to that. The difference with this case and commission and staff had guided Minn Kota in trying to file this application this particular way. Because it is so long, there can be advantages to first narrowing down the potential areas for which a route may go. And given the length of the line, we thought that would be the best way to do it. To do it other ways might invite just a lot more difficulty in the process of siting because you haven't sufficiently narrowed down the scope of where a particular line may go. So hopefully it also eliminates a lot of questions in the corridor routing phase or in the corridor permitting phase that don't have to then again be addressed at least in quite so much detail or controversy in the route siting phase.
The other thing I'd note about this project is a little different than previous, pipeline projects where we've had multiple hearings because of the length and the proximity to population is that each of these three hearings in three different locations will have as their primary focus that particular area, that geographic area, surrounding the site of the hearing. Sometimes we'll have a hearing where we'll have one sort of first hearing, and the first hearing sort of covers all of the evidence of the applicant, and then other hearings after that simply, sort of relate to an opportunity for citizen input. And in this particular case, we're going to focus on the geography in the close proximity to the location of each of the hearings. And in an attempt to hopefully have a very meaningful and thorough applicant's testimony as well as then citizen's testimony.
And you should have maps available, but that's a map of the route that, or the map of the project corridor that has been submitted. It probably bears repeating what this line is actually going to hook up. We've mentioned it on a couple of occasions, but just to refresh everyone's memory, this will essentially connect the Milton R. Young station near Center to the Minn Kota station, which serves the Northeast Valley, Northeast North Dakota, as well as the Minnesota side of the border. That's an existing coal plant, and the power generation outlet right now is primarily a DC line that runs into Northeast Minnesota. As part of an agreement with Minnesota Power, who had been a co-owner of the Milton R. Young station, Minnesota Power needs to provide more wind on their system to meet mandates in the state of Minnesota. They're divesting themselves of the Milton R. Young station. Minn Kota is going to be taking sole ownership of that and sole power from it. And then the existing DC line there is being reconditioned to support wind power from that part of the state. So by constructing this line, Minn Kota actually frees up resources to then fill up the DC line and subscribe it with wind power. So in a sense, it facilitates a fair amount of wind development in the state while continuing to keep a coal-based resource online as Minn Kota takes sole ownership of that power.
I would just offer up that this, I think Tony said it already, this is a major transmission line. And, we get a lot of public input prior to these hearings, and I'll tell you that I think these are going to be some spirited hearings because of just the size and scope of this transmission line.
I don't know how many landowners there are involved, but hundreds, maybe over 1,000. I don't know, but I would suspect 1,000 maybe.
It's by far the largest transmission line that the commission has cited in recent memory.
Certainly since I've been here. It's also interesting that when you describe the Minn Kota Minnesota swap, of all of the projects that we've talked about that have been proposed, all the solutions to the export capacity constraint, this is the first major solution that is the furthest along, and it's impressive.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That ends the items in my portfolio. Commissioner Kramer.
Commissioner Culp is next.
Very well. I'll give it a go. Item BK1. I move the commission issue a notice hearing and a notice of intent to consider information not presented at a hearing and Montana Dakota Utility Company's electric rate increase application, case number PU10124.
Second.
Basically, we have here, I guess, given the background, that on April 19th of 2010, MDU filed an application to increase its electric rates for services provided. And what we laid out at that point in time, it was a proposed 14% increase, rough cost to the average customer about $7.63. We scheduled public input hearings July 12th and 13th, which those were held. We also scheduled the public hearing that began on November 8th and actually went, I think, a full 4 days. So this case has been moving along for quite some time. Actually, we were scheduled to, I believe, vote on this at one time. But on March 14th, the commission received a settlement agreement executed by MDU and the North Dakota PSC advocacy staff. So we are going to schedule a hearing to review, I guess, the additional settlement agreement. I guess back up a little bit. On March 15th, the Missouri Valley Resource Council, which was an intervener in this case, they also filed a copy of the agreement executed. So we've got some of the groups have agreed to this settlement agreement, but what we need to do in the commission is basically go back out and have an additional public hearing to include information that we did not see in the initial hearing. So that has been scheduled on May 5th, 1 p.m. right here in our commission room. So this is the ongoing rate case and additional information. The commission, we had a lot of questions, I think, that came out during our work sessions, and now the process follows that we hear this additional information and we then move forward accordingly.
Whenever new evidence or testimony is put into the record, into a record where there's already been an evidentiary hearing, and the public has not had an opportunity to see it, nor have the sides had an opportunity to cross-examine that information or that testimony and evidence. Of course, we have to provide that opportunity and want to provide that opportunity. And some of the models and the modeling for the integrated resource plan for choosing generation is part of what's been entered now into evidence as part of this new settlement agreement. So we need an opportunity to take a look at it as commissioners, of course, and then hear any testimony and have the opportunity to examine it.
And part of the reason for, if not the reason for, a formal hearing is that in some cases where we need to get new information on the record, if there are not contested facts, then we can do that through an informal hearing. And that would provide staff or whoever else wants to provide information to the commission the ability to do so. In this case, we have a number of interveners, one of whom has not signed on to this. And so it's potentially contested facts, and those then need to be heard as part of a formal hearing.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Item BK2. I move the commission issue the notice of hearing, notice of intervention deadline, and notice of public input sessions in the Northern State Power Company's electric rate increase applications, case number PU10657 and PU11-55.
Second.
On December 10th of 2010, NSP filed an application to increase its rates for electric utility services based on a 2011 test year. Roughly a 12.2% increase was requested. On January 16th, this commission approved interim rate increase of 10.55%. Now, on February 8th, NSP filed an application to increase its revenue for electric utility services provided for the additional 2012 test year, which would roughly turn out to be a 2.57 electric rate increase. So what really has happened is we had the initial request from NSP for a rate case, and they decided to break this down, which will give us two test years of data to look at. We have scheduled a public hearing beginning on August 9th, 8 a.m. right here in the commission room, and I believe we scheduled 4 days for that hearing, so we've given ourselves plenty of time, given some of our previous experiences in rate cases. The public input sessions are set for May 23rd at 7 p.m. Central Time and May 24th at noon Central Time. We'll be having four locations for the public input sessions. Right here in the Capitol will be the location in Bismarck, right in our office. The Minot location will be Minot State University, Administrative Room 359, right there on campus. The Grand Forks location will be at UND, Abbott Hall, Room 119. And the Fargo location will be at NDSU, Morrill Hall, Room 170. So we're looking forward to having good hearings, good public input sessions, and just moving forward in this rate case as well.
These public input sessions will be broadcast over interactive television, which is why we're using multiple locations. How we'll use multiple locations, commissioners may also decide to split up and attend various locations, as well as, of course, XL staff.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That concludes the items in my portfolio.
Thank you, Commissioner Kramer.
Somehow I have KC4 on top. Let's get in order. All right. KC1, I move the commission adopt the hearing officer's recommended order of dismissal for the formal hearing that was requested in case number RC08694, bond release number 7 to surface coal mining permit BNCR8106, held by BNI Coal LTD for the Center Mine, making the bond release effective December 27, 2010. Second. We had approved the bond release for this BNI, about 195 acres at the BNI Center Mine back in December, as the motion reads. But, of course, before any bond release can become effective, anybody that feels like they're negatively impacted by the release of the bond has 30 days in which to request a formal hearing. On this particular case, on December 24th, Mr. Jeff Reinke of Center did send an email message requesting the formal hearing. His concerns were related to some pre-mine water sources that existed in parts of the mine that were to be released. Mr. Reinke then verbally withdrew the hearing request on February 11th of this year during a pre-hearing conference conducted by an administrative law judge. And at that time, he had indicated he planned to sign a proposed stipulation and agreement with the company. Whether he signed it or did not sign it, he did request again verbally to withdraw, and the judge recommended that we order the dismissal, and that's what we're doing today, which then makes the final bond release go into effect as of December 27th of last year.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
KC2. I move the commission deem the applications complete and issue a notice of filing and a notice of hearing in the request of Rangeland Energy LLC for a waiver of procedures and time schedules, a corridor certificate, and a route permit for the construction of approximately 20 miles of crude oil pipeline in Williams County, North Dakota, case number PU10637.
Second.
We may have talked about this a little bit previously. When the letter of intent was received, this is kind of an interesting project in that this is what's considered a midstream transmission project. They're proposing to build a what they call a Colt hub. I think that's crude oil loading terminal hub in Williams County, and then a 20-mile pipeline to another facility where that would then be the oil would then be available to be loaded onto various transmission sources such as rail facilities, Enbridge's pipeline, Tesoro pipeline. Rangeland is a fairly new company that saw this opportunity in Williams County, noticing that there was a lot of trucks. Imagine that, a lot of trucks that are carrying oil to terminals, to transmission terminals and whatnot. And so they seized that opportunity. They filed a letter of intent and now an application. It's about 20 miles, as I said, of I think it's 8-inch pipeline. We should maybe get a map in case anybody's interested in seeing the map of the area. But basically where it begins is the hub, this Colt hub, is located near Epping. And then the line would take the oil from that area to their other facility, which will be about 8 miles south of Tioga. And, of course, we know there's a lot of infrastructure at Tioga where you could then on-ramp onto several other facilities and transmission opportunities. The cost of this project is estimated to be about $15 million. I knew that Dave Thompson would pick up his pen at that moment. and I anticipated the question, Dave. So the cost of the project is anticipated to be about $15 million.
All in favor?
Aye.
I should state that the hearing is scheduled for 10 a.m. on 10 a.m. Central Time at the Tioga City Hall in Tioga, North Dakota on, why am I not seeing the date on here?
I noticed that too. I don't know if it's not on for scheduling for the date, so I don't know if we just missed that date or if we have to schedule that.
It should be on the schedule.
It's on, okay.
Okay. It's not on.
We'll get the information
right
on all of that. But I also might note that this will be a hearing that the commission will not attend. We have decided on some of these some of these cases to utilize the administrative law judges just to accommodate the scheduling, frankly, that has become very challenging with so many of these.
Well, I would say to further talk about the scheduling, the challenge becomes is that, you know, right now we schedule things, you know, as they come up, and it's not a problem scheduling in June, July, May, but when the companies need something scheduled immediately, that's right. When the challenge becomes, because the schedules get full. So it's just a matter of a sign of the growth going on in the state right now and just the planning time frame.
Yeah. All right, KC3. I move the commission approve renewal number 4 to surface coal mining permit number NACT9001, held by the Coteau Properties Company for the Freedom Mine, to extend the permit term for an additional 5 years until April 16th of 2016.
Second.
This is pretty much just your standard renewal for 5 more years. It's on about 2,819 acres of the Coteau Mine. It is an area of the mine where all the coal has been removed, but portions of the permit continue to be used for haul roads, sedimentation ponds, stockpiles, all those things that go on in mining.
All in favor?
Aye. KC4. I move the commission deem the application complete and issue a notice of filing and a notice of hearing in the request for Bearpaw Energy LLC for a certificate of site compatibility for the construction and operation of 2 100 million standard cubic feet per day gas processing plants in Williams County, North Dakota, case number PU10666.
Second.
Who chooses these numbers, anyways? let me say right up front before I forget to, the public hearing on this application is scheduled to begin at 12 noon Mountain Daylight Time at the City Hall at 165 Railroad Street, Southeast Williston, North Dakota. And again, this will be on scheduling, I guess. Bearpaw Energy has been very aggressively building out its, especially gas infrastructure in North Dakota. You might recall that we had cited a facility about the same size called the Garden Creek gas plant, which is currently under construction, largely site preparation at this point, near Watford City, North Dakota. And you'll see that we have another motion coming up shortly in reference to that facility. They also own another facility in McKenzie County, a smaller gas plant. We received the first letter of intent on this state line project in December of last year, where they let us know of their intent to build 100 million cubic feet per day gas plant with the possibility that it would be expanded to 2 on the same site. Then in February, I guess it was, we received another letter letting us know of their intention to, in fact, go ahead with both 100 million cubic feet per day facilities on the same site, and they filed an application for both. So Bearpaw continues to be very aggressive in terms of trying to take advantage of this marketable gas and process it into a marketable product. And the good news, of course, is every time we do that, not only does it add value to the resources coming out of the Bakken, especially the gas resources, which are really secondary to the oil, but it also eliminates that much more of the flaring that's going on and utilizes this, while abundant, still precious natural resource.
This flaring issue is a real challenge for North Dakota because on one hand, we very much have an interest in ensuring that our natural resources are not simply flared off and wasted. But what has caused this situation to be, I think, rather acute right now is a very interesting issue with regard to the differential in pricing between oil and natural gas. And in the past, you didn't get quite so much, whereas in past years, oil and gas, energy in general, tended to go up and down together. Because North Dakota is an oil-first play, it's oil that's driving whether there are rigs operating. It's oil that's driving the development in that part of the state, and yet the natural gas comes along with it. The concern is that natural gas prices are fairly cheap right now. Oil prices are absolutely at the other end of the spectrum. They're very high, and it's very lucrative to continue drilling. So the question is, what do you do with this resource that we don't want to waste, should be captured, and yet the marketing availability for it is not the same as it is for the oil? And that has to do with the international market for natural gas right now, which is being driven by huge shale gas plays in the southern plains and through Arkansas and up into the Marcellus Shale in the northeast part of the country. So it's, on one hand, natural gas, it's a nice break for consumers to have affordable natural gas. On the other hand, it's causing some real challenges as far as the investment cycle and how do we deal with this issue of flaring. And it's something that I think we'll continue to struggle with. But clearly, the one way that you can help alleviate the flaring of natural gas is by building more processing plants and gas pipelines in the state.
Well, and you could even take that a step further. We had MDU in here last week giving us an update on their resource planning, and they're considering making electricity out of natural gas in some of their plants. So it'll be interesting how this will change the electricity generation resource mix in North Dakota.
Certainly will.
All in favor?
Aye.
KC5, I move the commission acknowledge the letter of intent to shorten the one-year waiting period between filing a letter of intent and a siting application to 30 days and assess a filing fee of $100,000 due upon filing an application in case number PU1166, Bear Paw Energy LLC's proposed natural gas liquids pipeline in McKenzie County, North Dakota.
Second.
Earlier I referenced the Garden Creek plant that is under construction just to the east of Watford City. This is a proposed 10.75-inch diameter pipeline that would run about 64 miles long, 55.3 of which will be located in the state of North Dakota, and that is to carry some of the natural gas liquids out of that facility into Montana and to other facilities where it will then be marketed further. So everything seems to be in order. The approximate cost of this facility is $24 million. The approximate investment in the previous facility is $273 million. Just another day at the PSC. $100 million here, $100 million there. Anyway, everything's in order.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That ends the items in my portfolio.
And that ends the items on the agenda. Future meetings as well as hearings are listed in your agenda. There are no closing comments. We'll take questions.
Could you please repeat the on KC4, the hearing time? Because there's noon.
Yeah, what's the date of that hearing, Pat?
We haven't scheduled that one yet.
That's on scheduling, yeah.
Well, what baffled me a little bit is you mentioned Mountain Time, and I understood that the Williston.
12 noon. Yeah, it says 12 noon Mountain Daylight Time. So I imagine that's not the case. It'll be Central Daylight Time. Okay. Public hearing on the application is scheduled to begin at 12 noon Central Daylight Time in the City Hall in Williston, and we're going to schedule the date.
On someday.
Okay.
Pretty soon.
But it is Central Time, noon.
It is.
Williston City Hall.
Yeah.
Williston,
yep.
City Hall.
You are a good catch.
I wanted to ask about the pipeline, power line real quick. Have they given you a timetable about, converting the other one to the wind power and getting this one constructed?
Well, yeah, I'll answer as best I can off the top of my head. Tony, you can weigh in because you'll know the truth. as I recall, that conversion issue, the legal conversion has taken place, I think, basically. And as you know, Minnesota Power is building out their own wind farm in Morton and Morton County and then in and around Center. And they're currently constructing the second phase of Bison 1. We have received an application for Bison 2. So they're building out their generation at an interesting pace, I think. And I think that the timeline for this line to be in the 345 kV line to be in service is sometime 2013, I think, at the end of 2013. So I think, you know, if you pursue that line a little bit further, the question I have in my mind is, will there be adequate generation to maximize the potential on the DC line while the 345 kV line goes into operation and takes Milt Young power to Grand Forks?
Well, and the demand will probably drive some of that, and demand is down in some of those areas that it will potentially serve.
Not to mention the politics in Minnesota has changed, and it's hard to know what may come of that demand as it relates to mandates.
Just so that I'm clear, the existing line is being converted to a carrier of wind power, and this new line to be built will be taking coal power from the Milton Young station.
That's it.
Okay. We could go back to the grain insolvency.
Mm-hmm.
One of the claimants, John Wold, the claim that is approved is larger than the claim he filed. Could you explain that, please? This claim filed $414.22 and valid credit sale claim $872.48. And I was trying
that
to
may be a price basis for the date setter. Is that was the number of bushels?
Of course it is.
Excuse me. Where's
Exhibit A?
Okay. Okay. I got it. And just so that I'm clear, the cash claim is being paid from the bond, and the rest of the claims are being paid from the credit.
Although the bond was available, this is going to be able to be paid through the trust fund itself, which has available to it both the bond and other assets that the commission can commandeer. Okay. And in this case, there were a number of accounts receivable that were paid.
Okay.
So the commission will have the ability to pay 100% plus a interest for the valid cash sale claim. And in addition, we'll be able to pay commission expenses, which are provided for under the law. In addition, the credit sale contract fund will provide as much payment as it's able to provide under the law, which is 80%.
What are the commission expenses, approximately?
Oh, the commission expenses that we're filing for are, Sue, do you remember the page that it's on?
It's Exhibit B.
Okay. Oh, there it is. Yeah. Just over
$26.50.
Just over $1,000.
Can you explain the difference in the claim that Mr. Hapka filed and what is being approved to be paid to him?
That's the cash sale.
Yes.
Claim.
It's a storage charge?
Yeah, there was a storage charge which totaled $3,500 roughly, which was an invalid item. And then there were some adjustments that needed to be made with regard to the grain prices, too.
And the construction company tried to make a claim on the credit sale fund for construction work that was done?
I think it was money that they were owed for construction work, but that's not a valid claim under state.
I know, but they filed a claim against the credit sale contract fund for this amount of money that they said they were owed.
That's correct.
For repair work, and it was denied because you don't, that isn't don't what you get paid
right,
for out of the,
right.
Okay.
Suppose if construction companies paid into it, we could make some.
On KC-5,
mm-hmm.
Okay, we have, could you please tell me again where the pipeline begins and ends?
The pipeline begins at, or will begin, at the Garden Creek processing plant, gas processing plant, which is near Watford City.
And it's going east or west?
It will go west, 64.2 miles.
You know where the terminus is?
I'm going to get the. It'll. Let's see here. Well, I have the map. I want to look at that. It's in Richland County of Montana. I don't know what community is close to it. The first 55.3 miles are all in North Dakota. The remainder is in Richland County of Montana. It's going to transport about 65,000 barrels of natural gas liquids per day.
Is that how they're measured? Is by barrels?
Liquids. It's liquid natural gas. The NGLs are, yeah.
Okay.
Of course, the natural gas is, the processed gas is measured in million cubic feet.
But, you know, the Bear Paw plant produces natural gas liquids, and this pipeline will take those liquids to Montana.
To Montana, to a facility that they already have, I think, in Richland. And I don't know this, but I suspect there's probably either a rail facility or maybe another I doubt it's a processing facility, but probably a, and maybe Molly knows this, but, oh, no, you're not with Earth Rangeland, but a possibly a transmission facility.
And KC-4, you're going to schedule that on admin?
Momentarily, yep.
Okay.
If you want to go, we can send down those dates.
I was going to hang out here anyway because I want to see what you talk about as far as that funky wind tower. Can you explain the nature of the
information?
You said
funky, right? Yeah, okay.
The nature of the information that was not presented at a hearing that
mm-hmm.
was discussed subsequent to the hearing. What was this? Can you describe the nature of this information?
Well, this is the
modeling.
The MDU?
Yeah.
I guess my best guess is during the work sessions, it became apparent to, I guess, the three of us had, I think, similar concerns about the modeling that was used to show the wind as the least cost alternative, or actually a cost to show on it. So we asked a lot of questions about, okay, show us the different models that you use and how you got to the plan of picking wind as your option. And that was one thing that I never got that information to base a decision on. So as we got closer to a potential vote on where we were going, I was quite honestly looking at maybe dismissing some of those things. And then, I can't speak for the other commissioners, but then the settlement agreement appears, and I believe it has a lot of that information in it that should show the cost modeling.
Well, and to help determine the delta between the lowest cost and the actual generation that they chose. In other words, if the ratepayers of the North Dakota ratepayers are to pay their portion of Montana Dakota's investment in generation resource that wasn't the lowest cost, then what was the lowest cost? What would the delta be so that that's really what we're after, was the delta between the lowest cost and the chosen.
The settlement, I think it's fair to say, is probably no doubt a result of listening into the commission negotiations.
Well,
on
you gave so many hints,
the
Tony.
Hearing, yeah.
Yeah.
What we ended up with, and again, we're just sort of all individually speaking because we never did make a determination on this, and we'll hear more, but the concern that I had was that while there may be evidence in the record that some level of cost recovery was appropriate for these wind farms, the record itself, in my opinion, was not fully developed enough for us to determine exactly what were prudent costs. And so the question is, if I believe there were some that were available that should have been recovered from ratepayers, what is the level? And that's where Kevin's comment about the delta, the how much over the lease cost were these wind farms, that's what we needed to get a handle on, and that was not very fully developed in the record. As part of the settlement agreement, there is an attachment and an attempt to further develop justification for what the costs were above what lease cost planning would have been.
Is the settlement agreement on the website?
I don't know if it is posted to the web. It is posted to the web. It's available.
But essentially, what the information that has not been made public at the hearing, but you want to have a hearing to discuss and make public, is to.
Well, it's not that it's not public. It's a matter of getting it formally introduced into the room.
That's what I was trying to say. I'm sorry, I was not able to do it.
And there's questions that'll come out of this too, obviously, and then just needs to be reinforced too that this settlement agreement has not been signed by all parties that intervened. So, I mean, the procedure says that we do what we're doing now, but there's a lot of questions that I will have to have answered.
Well, what you want to put into the record, as I understand it, is information about the cost above the lowest cost.
Any cost data.
Well, that's what attachments to the settlement detail. But the settlement itself will be entered into the record at that point, too.
Just as a matter of interest, it's going to be more than a year since the case was actually filed. Is that a long time to dispose of a case like this, or are we going to see more of this? It's going to take some time just to go through all the various twists, turns.
It's interesting. The three of us talked before about maybe changing that time frame from 7 months to a year to be something more reasonable anticipating this, and I think that's going to become the norm. As we look at this pending NSP case, it doesn't look any easier than the one we're going through right now with MDU.
Here's what's happened from a practical reality is the cases have gotten more complex, and on the flip side of it, the utility companies are less concerned now, excuse me, are less concerned now about having the commission stick strictly to that six-month time frame. And the reason is because of the interim rate law that the legislature passed, the utilities can start recovering these costs immediately, and then the commission sifts through the record. And in the traditional rate-making way of doing things, the rates didn't go into effect until the case itself was decided. So during the case, the rates hadn't increased, and the utilities had an incentive to try to push the commission to stick to that statutory deadline of 6 or 7 months very strictly.
Well, and one of the things that I thought a lot about, and I think the other gentleman did too, is that this is not any particular rate case, but we were just talking about natural gas. You know, as companies go forward and decide what it is they're going to build for their generation, there needs to be some modeling, in my opinion, that they use to get to, so when it comes back to a rate case, they can justify why it is they built whatever they built. And with the variability in costs and these things, it's going to become more and more challenging, I think, as we go through these rate cases, because the questions will come, how did you get to this particular resource mix? And that's why I think the IRPs are going to become more and more important that companies submit with us. And we've got Chris on staff now that almost a big chunk of his job is going through the IRPs, and going back to just MDU's discussion the other day was letting us know some of their thinking. They talked about coming in for some ADPs. We might see some more of those in the future. It's just getting to be a more complicated world.
Just a quick question about the insolvency again. Do you know which judge is handling this?
Yes, I can get it for you.
Basically, this is your report to him or her, and
it is.
It's Lori. That's why I said her. Her.
Judge Fontaine.
Okay.
Okay.
This point,
you know,
we're all.
Do you know who the principals are in Rangeland Energy?
I had that information during the letter of intent, and I don't have it now. But if you go on, if you Google it, you'll find out. It's a relatively new, it's a very new firm, basically, that started up specifically to find midstream solutions to about three different plays. The Niebuhr Roller, is that what it's called, over in Wyoming play. There's one, of course, ours, which is the first one, and then there's one other one that they have an interest in, I think, in Texas. It's really a development corporation or an investment corporation that formed, and then they formed Rangeland Energy, which now has formed into Rangeland LLC.
And the power line application makes reference to a 1,000-foot corridor. Could you, and that one of the subjects mm-hmm. we discussed, could you just talk about why that?
That's actually a smaller corridor than could have been filed under the law. Because it's such a long transmission line, you could have had a significantly larger corridor. I think there are a number of reasons for it. One is probably just from the applicant standpoint, the bigger the corridor, the larger the area that they have to survey. And if they have a fairly good sense of where they would like to eventually have the route go, they've narrowed that down. The other issue, which is the commission itself has been nudging utility companies and developers towards, is smaller-sited corridors. And the reason for it is a practical one. The law a few years ago was changed to provide that within a corridor, it becomes very easy to site future transmission lines, which on one hand can help facilitate energy development. On the other, if corridors are too large, it could have some unintended consequences, I think, from both a regulatory perspective and from a legislative one as well. And so it would probably cause extra concern and even extra due diligence on the commission's part if you had a large corridor, because you knew that you would be citing something that could potentially be used in the future to site even more infrastructure within that corridor.
So that begs a question for me is, how close is this corridor or how close is the line going to be to the existing DC line?
It touches at different points in some of these lines.
At the far west end,
it starts in the same place.
It starts in the same place, so it's closer to point.
Knowledge.
Right. The existing DC line, it's not quite the I-94 corridor, but
it pretty much runs straight east, doesn't it?
It basically runs straight east, right? And this one veers north, and then into Grand Forks County.
The challenge with a narrower corridor, however, is, of course, that once that corridor is sited and the certificate is issued, then the flexibility for the route is sort of diminished. Now, that means that they're going to do a lot, you know, a lot more thorough job probably in surveying the corridor itself. But therein does lie the challenge for the narrower corridor. But that's the company's decision. If they've done good work in advance and they have a pretty good clear idea of the route and what exists there.
There are remedies available. If for whatever reason they would need to change the corridor, they can file an amended route for just a portion of it if you needed some flexibility.
The challenge on that law that Tony referenced is that not only can other transmission be built with relatively easy siting or avoiding some siting procedures, but any energy development can take place within that corridor. So in essence, if you have a 6-mile wide corridor that's been previously sited and somebody decides they want to put a wind farm, that corridor might be a pretty good place to put the wind farm and avoid a siting hearing. Now, they still have to certify that there are no exclusion or avoidance areas that are imposed upon and all those things. But nonetheless, it might be an unintended consequence.
How big can the corridor be?
6 miles.
6 miles.
Well, see, the reason I asked is that I thought it would be in their interest to have a big corridor. For the reasons you mentioned.
Yes and no.
I mean, it's...
I like the idea of a larger corridor just because the fact that then you actually can have the ability to change the route if need be. When you get a very narrow corridor, if you get into the hearing and all of it later on down the road and you decide to change it, the corridor is not big enough. One of the things that I'll say concerned about going into this is that the methodology that they use to pick their route, because sometimes it goes to these existing transmission lines, there's the methodology how you get to there. I think a larger corridor, while it will perhaps cost more, it gives the commission more ability to move the route as things unfold, because we've in a sense constrained ourselves to a smaller area too. So there's I see two different viewpoints to that.
You can imagine though a 260-mile, 6-mile wide corridor, how much land that is to survey and you know. So it's you give and you take a little, I guess. They've made the decision.
But I don't think that we're restricted. If we get into the hearing and all of a sudden there's an area that we would like to change a little bit, like Tony said, that we could do that. So really? It's a starting point that if for some reason we'd have overwhelming thoughts to change it, I don't think that would be it could perhaps be done.
Any other questions? Hearing none, we will recess for just a few minutes for order signing and then move immediately after that, say at 11:30, to the administrative portion of the agenda, and we'll take up whatever items may be of interest to the public.
I hear a lot of pressure there.